Hi, I'm Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal, and you are listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing.
Yeah. My name is Abhay Dandekar, and I share conversations with talented and interesting individuals linked to the global Indian and South Asian community. It's informal and informative, adding insights to our evolving cultural expressions, where each person can proudly say, trust me, I know what I'm doing. Hi, everyone. On this episode of Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing, I share a conversation with United States Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal. Stay tuned. As always, thank you for listening to the show and for rating and kindly reviewing and following on those socials. It's very much appreciated and I'm so grateful. I've mentioned this before, but it really deserves repeating that one of our biggest demonstrations of trust in a free society is with our vote. So with general elections coming up in 2024 in both the US and in India, exercising your power through organizing, openly discussing, exchanging ideas respectfully, learning, and ultimately voting are all privileges and imperatives. So it was terrific to share a conversation with the first Indian American woman to serve in the US Congress, representing the 7th district in the state of Washington, Pramila Jayapal. Pramila was born in India and emigrated here when she was just a teenager to go to college and then get her graduate degree. She spent 20 years working internationally and domestically in global public health and development, and as an award-winning national advocate for women's, immigrant, civil, and human rights. Pramila entered life as an elected official as a Washington State Senator representing much of Seattle in 2015. And then, 2 years later, she was elected to the U.S. House of Representatives and has served as one of the few naturalized citizens in Congress. Pramila has been an active leader serving on the Judiciary and Education and Workforce Committees. Her signature has been advocating to bridge inequities and support vulnerable communities, working for fair wages, broader healthcare access, climate justice, LGBTQ equality, and improved housing. Pramila has also notably been the chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, which represents nearly 50% of the entire Democratic caucus in the House. And she's known for sharing her views boldly and fighting for her values. Now, I learned more about her work last fall when I was spreading the word about the Save Our Hearts campaign to support the South Asian Heart Health and Research Act, which she introduced last year. And so we were able to catch up and talk about a broad range of things, actually right after the Super Bowl, where we both shared that ironically, neither the anxiety of a close game nor eating nachos were really helping either of our hearts. But I also wanted to know if viewing the Super Bowl, an incredibly American display of consumerism and excess, was at all challenging, given the backdrop of deep struggles of so many in the community who represent issues that she cares so deeply about.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm not a huge sports person. I have learned to kind of embrace pieces of it. And so it doesn't impinge on my consciousness so much. I have come to really love Seattle hockey, you know, ice hockey, the Kraken. And I love our women in sports. And I particularly love soccer because I grew up in other parts of the world where soccer was much more the game of choice. So I don't necessarily think about the connection all the time, though I think you're raising some good points. I just think that at the end of the day, people are looking for ways to feel good. And a lot of these things are at least nominally making people feel good. Now, what it's doing for my heart, you know, I think eating nachos is probably not the best thing for my heart, but it was a really fun thing to do. And it's sort of like people think about the Super Bowl in that way. I think the ads make me very uncomfortable because the enormous amount of money that goes into television advertising, if you were just to take all of that money and actually put it into housing and healthcare and all these other things, we would have a very different country. And I think that's always something that just it's the largesse of it in a way is difficult for me to process as much as I might enjoy the ad for, you know, whatever the 30 seconds is or 15 seconds that it's up there. So I think that is a big part of the problem with how much money drives things in the United States, but it doesn't drive happiness, as you and I know, and it doesn't drive health either necessarily, but certainly the inequities are much greater for people who are low income, who are low wealth, because they simply don't have the same kind of access.
And that's the right word. I mean, largesse is kind of juxtaposing that is so tough on a not just a signature day where you see ads and that are bombarded at you, but of course, trying to then make policy and movement that is going to bridge some of those gaps. You know, for you as someone who is chairing the CPC and kind of leading progressives out there, what's then the strategy that, you know, you have to employ to get closer to bridging those gaps, almost closer to the finish line on the issues that we talked about, but then so many others, you know, climate justice and reproductive rights, especially in a very, very targeted election year.
Yeah. Well, I always say that, you know, people ask me what it means to be a progressive. And I always say being a progressive just means you are the first to the best and most just idea. And then you build the movement and everyone comes along sometimes 10 years later.
Yeah.
I think about the minimum wage as a perfect example of that, where we were pushing for a $15 minimum wage. In fact, Seattle became the first major city a decade ago to pass a $15 minimum wage. And here we are still trying to get it at the federal level, but more and more states are implementing it, red and blue states, by the way. It's not a partisan thing. And so I think that is often, as progressives, we are out there in front. Student debt cancellation was something that we never could have dreamed of 5 years ago, but we were able to build the movement to get the president to cancel student debt, even though it got held up in the courts by Republicans. And even without that, he has canceled student debt for more than 4 million Americans across the country. So I think that a lot of our work is about the movement. It is about building the public pressure that allows people to change their worldview of what is possible. Because a lot of times we're told that politics is the art of the possible, which is true. But what people don't say is the possible is not static. It actually can move and be moved. And the limits of what defines a possible are often defined by what has happened in the past, but it doesn't mean that's where we have to be for the future. So one of the great successes, I think, of the progressive movement was in 2020, in the lead up to the Biden administration and President Biden coming in as the president, we had these Biden-Sanders unity task forces. And it was really to bring together the big tent of the Democratic Party. And I co-chaired the healthcare one with another wonderful Indian American, our Surgeon General, who's a dear friend of mine, Dr. Murthy. And we were able to kind of put together a set of things that we would want to move forward in a Biden presidency. Now, we got some of those things accomplished, not all of them. But I think that agenda that the president came in with was a very progressive agenda. And we got a tremendous amount done in the first 2 years of his presidency that were progressive things. We didn't call it a progressive agenda. We called it the president's agenda. That was a very strategic thing to do. But if you look at the things that we accomplished, from, you know, real investments in infrastructure to the largest investment ever in taking on climate change, 40% for environmental justice, those are all things that were part and parcel of the progressive agenda that we were able to get across the finish line.
You know, you mentioned the politics of what's possible. For you so far in your congressional career, has that target of what's possible had to evolve and change, especially with thinking of, you know, what informs you on a daily, monthly, yearly basis?
Yeah. Yeah, there's no question. I mean, you know, the difference between being on the outside and being on the inside is that we have to press a button, you know, multiple times a day to vote yes or no. And so we have to make a judgment about whether this is the best we can get. I think progressives, and I'm really proud of chairing the CPC and our role in Build Back Better, which the president has personally told me over and over again. He and I have actually become, you know, close, even though we don't agree on everything. But he told me over and over again that it wouldn't have been possible without the CPC, without progressives and the progressive movement, and without the progressive caucus. Because at the end of the day, we are interested in governing. So did we get everything we wanted? No, we held the line on passing the infrastructure bill until we got Build Back Better. We passed the infrastructure bill. And then even though we didn't get Build Back Better, it became the basis of the Inflation Reduction Act, which never would have happened had we not insisted on holding the line in the first place. So I think, you know, yes, we have to think about what's possible. And it is a judgment call. So that's, I think, sometimes the challenge is people think if you, you know, if you can hold out longer, maybe you could get more. And there is a moment where you have to decide if that's all you can get or if you can get more and what the best strategy is to try to get as much as you can.
It's funny, I think back to when I first started practicing as a pediatrician and those first days compared to now, like the battles I want to pick with folks versus yes. the things that I am able to accomplish. Do you remember your very first day in Congress? And especially reflecting back.
Very clearly.
What was that first day like, especially in thinking to what your career has been so far? Do you remember what was maybe the biggest surprise from that first day?
I don't know about surprise, but I was absolutely awed walking into the place and realizing the history that I was walking into.
Yeah.
You know, the first and still only South Asian American woman to be elected to the House, still one of only 100 women of color that have ever served in Congress since the founding of our country.
Right.
Still only one of just, you know, 24 naturalized citizens. At the time, it was a dozen. Today, it's about 24 naturalized citizens to serve in Congress at this time. And so I think I have always been awed by the opportunity and the responsibility, both. And I think that if you aren't anymore, it's probably time for you to leave, whether or not you do.
Right.
But I still feel that way.
Yeah.
You know, I think that part of the reason I work so hard is because I realize that it's not just for me, it's all the people that come after me. I have to do a really great job, both so that we can deliver policy to make lives better for millions of people, and so that other people are going to have a chance to do what I'm doing, and we can really diversify Congress and make it a place that reflects democracy at its highest ideal, which is the full participation and representation of everyone.
Yeah, it's staggering how much, you know, how much has happened and also how far we still have to go. You're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. After a quick break, let's come back to our conversation with Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal. Stay tuned. Conversation. It's the antidote to apathy and the catalyst for relationships. I'm Abhay Dandekar, and I share conversations with global Indians and South Asians so everyone can say, trust me, I know what I'm doing. New episodes weekly, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Hey, this is Cal Penn. I'm an actor, author, former public servant, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing.
Hello, everyone. My name is Tam France.
Hi, I'm Congressman Ro Khanna.
Hi, my name is Richa Morjani, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing with Abhay Dandekar.
Welcome back to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. Let's rejoin our conversation now with Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal. In thinking about the last 6 or 7 years now, juxtaposed from that kind of first sense of awe and that great spirit of responsibility and how much, you know, you've accomplished, what are perhaps some of the things you've had to maybe unlearn or relearn, particularly when you know, so far as a congresswoman, but again, particularly as a woman of color, as someone who's representing those naturalized people, what are some of those kind of lessons or either learnings or unlearnings that you've maybe had to unpack?
I think, you know, some of the learnings are, I used to have a woman of color legislative aide in the state Senate. And she would sometimes say, you know, God, my prayer in the morning is God grant me the confidence of a mediocre white man. I would often laugh at that. But yeah. I think that there is a sense of sort of, I'm here, I know what I'm doing, I'm prepared, even though you can never be prepared completely, but really a sense of being willing to listen to yourself and your intuition. Because in politics, one of the things that I think is really important for me anyway is I am ambitious for what I want to achieve. I am not ambitious for the title.
Yeah.
The title allows me to do other things. But I tell a lot of people that I mentor that they should think about what they want to do, not who they want to be, because you can have any title you want. I could have lots of titles, but at the end of the day, it's how do you use the power that you have? And in fact, that's the book I wrote, is Use the Power You Have. And so I think being able to, another lesson is assess all the places where you have power and then be strategic about how you use it. Power is not bad in and of itself. It's about how you use it. And I think there are a lot of progressives out there who are like, oh no, I don't like power. I'm not powerful. No, I'm powerful. I like power. I like it if I can use it for other people. I also think, you know, being prepared is something that I just remembered. One of the things I love about this job is I am learning stuff every day. I mean, stuff that I had no idea. I love that. I'm not daunted by what I don't know. Mm. I just want to get deeper into it and I want to figure it out and I want to understand it and know what I can do to make a difference. And so just that remembrance again of being willing to not know things and being excited and curious about learning them. I think those are all lessons that I've relearned and or applied in my time in Congress.
And certainly, I mean, like the impact of that curiosity allows for, you know, less rigidity, more action.
Yeah.
And you mentioned this idea of not only just wielding power, but having the next steps of what to do with that and making those sound decisions.
Right.
Unfortunately, of course, Congress doesn't enjoy a ton of popularity because sometimes from the public face, it's so hard to necessarily see movement and that things are getting actually done. From a public approval standpoint, maybe what are some of the misconceptions that you find the public has, but particularly about the idea of how much compromise actually does,
yeah,
or for that matter, doesn't happen?
Yeah, well, a couple things on that. One is, you know, people often are very favorable about their member of Congress, but not about Congress as a whole. So
right.
I think that's an important distinction. And I think that discrepancy comes up because most people don't understand how the rules are structured in Congress. And that's why part of my, you know, push has been, don't just change the rulers, right? The people who are there in Congress making decisions. Of course, we want, I'm a Democrat, so we want Democrats to win. So there's often a focus on who do we bring in, but you also have to change the rules. And one of the things, for example, that I didn't know before I came in, and I was pretty educated, I did not realize how much of a barrier the filibuster was.
Mm.
And of course, it's gotten to be more of a barrier as Congress has become more and more partisan, but it is really a structural disaster,
yeah,
for getting anything done. And so unless, and it's also a legacy of Jim Crow. I mean, it was really utilized to block segregation or to allow segregationists to continue the legacy of slavery and
sure.
Jim Crow. And so I think, you know, for people to understand in a very simplistic way, when I talk about the filibuster, I say there's this thing called the filibuster in the Senate. And basically it allows 40% of senators, 40 senators who represent 11% of the country's population to block anything, not just from being voted on, but from being debated.
Right.
And so unless we change the filibuster, we're not going to be able to pass the things that the People's House passes because we have a simple majority. So we can pass sensible gun reforms. We can pass the Equality Act. We can pass climate justice. We can pass, the codifying abortion. We can pass all these things. And then they go to the Senate, which is, I call it the graveyard where all good things go to die because of the filibuster. And most people in the country are like, I don't know what you're talking about. But when I explain that to them, they're like, oh.
Yeah.
And so what does that mean? It means we have to get 50 senators who are willing to get rid of the filibuster. So that's the next push, right? So that we can pass all these things that we're talking about.
Well, and hopefully it means that as people not only just get more educated, but they mobilize, they register, they get people in there who are also willing to understand that, you know, perhaps that ability to compromise, you know, needs some machinery to be,
yeah,
you know, moved a little bit.
You know, just one quick thing on that. The interesting thing is that people talk a lot about how we don't have any bipartisan, you know, we have very little bipartisanship, which, by the way, isn't true. We actually do. I do a lot of stuff with the other side, strangely enough. Even right now, we're working on FISA reform and making sure that there's a warrant to spy on Americans. But also, if you got rid of the filibuster, I actually think we would have more bipartisan bills, because right now we need 10 Republicans to do anything in the Senate. So 5 or 6 that are willing to go along are not going to do it because they know it's never going to go anywhere. So why take the risk on something more challenging? Whereas if we got rid of the filibuster, I think we would actually really promote bipartisanship in a new way, because you wouldn't have this 10-person threshold, and you would actually be able to get more and more people who would come along with you.
Yeah, opening up more lanes for people who are kind of there, but you know, able to make a little bit more risk. I want to ask something that, of course, has been hot in both the Senate and in the House these last couple of weeks. But you know, you're someone who has a deep empathy for this. You're an immigrant yourself. And as you came to the U.S. as a teenager, and reflecting on some of those experiences now, at least, why is finding a solution to immigration and reforming our structures and really helping to solve problems at the border, why is this so elusive, you know, for Congress to be able to act on this?
It goes right back to what I just said. What has happened is immigration has been used as a political football, primarily by Republicans, for over 30 years. And Democrats, my critique of Democrats is we haven't stood up and tried to push for immigration reform when we had the shot, but we haven't had very many shots because of the filibuster. And so for 30 years, we've had a system that has had the same visa caps, the same numbers for how many people we let in as we did 30 years ago. And you know what's happened to the population of the world in that time. You know what's happened to the population of the United States in that time. And so the idea that we would have 8 million people not able to be processed in what we call the family backlog. These are family members who have applied for other family members, and they have to wait 20 years. If you're from India, 20 years, Philippines, 25 years. Or on the employment side, if we have 2 million people who have jobs, who have employers who are willing to sponsor them, but they can't get their visas because of these arbitrary caps that have been put in place. And so what has happened is we've got a legal system that literally is not functioning. And you add on to that the fact that Republicans under Donald Trump really stripped resources away from all the agencies that process people. So we don't have enough people processing. We don't have enough immigration judges. We don't have enough asylum officers at the border. We have a legal system that's not working. And unless we actually fix that, we are not going to be able to stop undocumented migration across the southern border. There is an inverse relationship between legal pathways and the legal system working and undocumented migration across the southern border. And the more you increase legal pathways, the less undocumented migration you have. And for Americans, they just want to know that we have a legal, orderly process for people to get in. And we don't right now. And so that's what we need. It's not going to happen unless we have filibuster reform, because look at Lindsey Graham. He was part of the gang, it was called the Gang of Eight, that in 2013 passed a comprehensive bipartisan immigration reform bill, 68 bipartisan votes, if you can believe it. John Boehner was the Speaker of the House, Republican Speaker. He said, I'm not going to bring it to the floor because my extreme Republican Party doesn't want me to, because they know it would pass. So he didn't bring it to the floor.
Right.
We put all this money into enforcement at the border, and none of it has worked because we don't actually reform the system that allows people to come to this country.
You're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. After a quick break, we'll return to our conversation with Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal. Stay tuned. Every story told is a lesson learned, and every lesson learned is a story waiting to be told. I'm Abhay Dandekar, and I share conversations with global Indians and South Asians so everyone can say, trust me, I know what I'm doing. New episodes weekly, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Lily Singh, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing.
I'm Prince Bojwani, CEO of Asana Voices.
I'm Sarah Shaw, the Director of Policy and Community Engagement with Indian American Impact. I'm Anika Sharma. I'm the founder and co-host of That They See Spark. And you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing.
By the way, Prince, Sarah, and Anika have all spearheaded the Save Our Hearts campaign to advance South Asian heart health and research. So please take a look at the link in the show notes to learn more and have a listen to our discussion in episode 185. Let's now rejoin our conversation with Congresswoman Pramila Jaipal. You know, you mentioned more lanes opening up, and, you know, certainly that sort of clears it. I look at it as, you know, pretty simple traffic jams that are out there, but
correct.
At the same time, having the political will to do so. Political will definitely is something that you gain as you take more risks and you're understanding where, you know, your roles lie and where the strategy is. But particularly, you mentioned, I mean, of course, you are the first, you know, Indian American congresswoman. But what does actually being the first Indian American congresswoman mean in 2024 compared to when you first entered Congress? Has there been an evolution of what that means to you, what it perhaps means to the growing and evolving and changing community of not just Indian Americans, but South Asian Americans, Asian Americans, Pacific Islanders, the coalitions that we build in some ways?
Yeah. I think that I don't necessarily think it's changed, but I think that the Indian American community is growing and is complex. It isn't monochromal, you know,
right.
it's monochromatic. It is really very complex. And I think that the growing power of India as a country and the relationship between the United States and India means that things are quite different today than they were even a decade ago. And the expectations of Indian Americans is quite different today. I have always believed that we have more work to do in our own community to teach people what it means to build coalition and how to organize. You know, we're very good at going and standing in a picture and, you know, being involved politically in that way. But what does it mean to actually have an agenda for the Indian American community and push that agenda, but to do it in partnership with other communities that have had agendas for much longer than we do, you know, than we have had? And so that, I think, is something that I've been continuing to try to work with our community on. I think what gives me a lot of hope is the young generation of Indian Americans who largely grew up here in this country or came here when they were very young. And they are much more integrated in their thinking about coalition building, about organizing, even about progressive politics. And so I've been engaging a lot with that community because my values are consistent, whether you like them or not. They're very consistent. I've always been a champion for human rights. I've always been a champion for progressive policies. I am not afraid to criticize my own government, even when I have a close relationship with the president. And I'm not afraid to criticize my birth country government. By the way, you know, where my parents still live. I've never lived on the same continent as my parents since I was 16.
Yeah.
And so I'm very tied to India. I have a deep love of India in a way that's very different from others. But I also have, you know, a very developed sense of what I'm fighting for and what's right and wrong. And I think that for a lot of Indian Americans, they're still developing some of those political sensibilities about where they stand and still kind of trying to put together the coalition around things like the Heart Health Bill or, you know, other policies that would help Indian Americans here at home.
You mentioned that this kind of grapple that people deal with, the tugs in so many different areas, and there's, like you mentioned, it's not monochromatic. There's a lot of multiplicity out there, and building coalitions and organizing is so important. So in a way, it does speak back, or at least beg the question of being an Indian, being of South Asian origin, being with, you know, having a community that has so many multiplicities there. How have you felt this impacts? I mean, you can only speak for yourself personally, but how do you think it impacts your patriotism as an American? Is it additive because of all these multiplicities and because of what it brings to the community, to that patriotism, but particularly, especially in a global community that just continues to grow closer, connected every day, and also gets more complex every day too?
I absolutely think it adds to my patriotism. You know, I have great pride in being able to bring all of my experiences being born in India, growing up all over Asia, working all over Latin America. I think that is exactly what we need to develop the kind of global policies and global multilateral coalitions that we need on everything from peace and security to domestic policies, frankly. And so I see it as a huge plus. Of course, we get a lot of hate from people. And when they don't like us, they say, go back to your own country. Now, I've lived here, you know, I'm 58 years old and I've lived here since I was 16. So right. This is my country. Yeah. But I do get that. And I know there's been a lot of anti-Asian hate and South Asians, you know, have been a part of that, targeted as part of that. But I do think it's an exciting time for a lot of us who have lived in other parts of the world, do have a sense of what other cultures are, and are able to bring that wisdom here into the jobs that we have. And I also think that Americans overall are very loving, giving people in general. And if you look at the polling over immigration, despite the xenophobia and the rhetoric on the other side targeting immigrants, the American people generally are in favor of immigration. They want it to be orderly. They don't like the chaos, but they do believe that immigrants are good for this country. And they do have some connection to their own immigration story, even if they feel like that was a really different story. And people will sometimes say to me, well, why don't we go back and do it the way we did it at Ellis Island when my grandparents came in?
Right.
And I'm like, great, yeah. Let's do that. Because actually, there were no requirements.
That might
then
actually establish some more order. Right. Well, and you mentioned, you know, you mentioned your parents are still in India. And, you know, again, you're someone who's quite vocal in having agreements and disagreements and sticking to values in your way. But for two economic and strategic partners in India and the United States, whose relationship continues to evolve and deal with the complexities, what are you optimistic about when it comes to shared futures of these two democracies?
I'm so optimistic about the contributions that each country brings. I mean, I think India is phenomenal, just as I think the United States is phenomenal, for all my critiques of both. I think we have, it's the people more than even any single government. It's the people that I think give me the greatest hope. And I see Indian Americans involved in every single sphere, from medicine to services to technology to, you know, to politics. And in every sphere, I feel like there are some incredibly important contributions, and vice versa with Americans involved in India. I also think, by the way, that some of the history that I am so appreciative of that India brings, I'm a student of Mahatma Gandhi and the nonviolence movement, and I can't tell you how much it still comes up today when people come to my office and they see a picture of Gandhiji there on the wall next to a picture of His Holiness the Dalai Lama and me when I was able to go and visit. And I think that there are stories and legacies that India has that no other country in the world has. And I think that's true of the United States as well. And so it's the partnership that I think is so important. It makes me so proud to have been born in the world's largest democracy and to be a citizen and a member of Congress of the world's oldest democracy.
I think one thing for sure is that we absolutely need to have much more narrative and storytelling to weave all that together. You know, you've been such a wonderful steward and advocate for democratic values. And of course, you know, the title of this is Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. But maybe that our ultimate show of trust as individuals in these democracies comes at the ballot box. So, you know, as a leader, as a progressive, as a woman of color, as a parent, as a progressive, as someone who's shared that they've had an abortion, as the parent of a trans person, how do you continue to cultivate trust? And particularly, by the way, with people who may currently disagree with you?
Yeah. Well, I'm very relational, and there's very few people I'm not willing to talk to. I will talk to anybody. I do believe in respectful dialogue. And you know, and so I think I won't talk to people who are disrespectful, but I will talk to people who are respectful and disagree, because I think that is the heart of what we do in this world, right? We talk to each other. And so that's really what I try to do. I do particularly focus on the younger generation, because so many of them come to me. You know, if I look at my fellows and my interns in the office, they're almost always Indian American young people, largely Indian American women, but also young men, who are just so excited to see me there and to know what it means for their future, right? It's not just that we're there, but it changes the possibilities for how people look at their futures. And so I think I'm intentional about wanting to mentor and be able to be present for the younger generation, but certainly with the older generation, where there might be more challenges sometimes around how we see, you know, the world. I also think that that's, you know, these are folks who have done amazing things, even if we disagree. And I think being relational is the most important thing for me. It's human to human. And at the end of the day, look, it's a tough world. And it's, I think being human is a courageous act in this day and age. And I think that if you can lead with your heart, if you can lead with your values, people might disagree with you, but at the end of the day, they still see you as somebody who cares about them. And that's really my goal.
Well, as someone who's leading with our shared humanity at stake, and on top of that, really developing relationships. And definitely one of the mantras of this show is that conversation is the antidote to apathy. We're grateful for That's all right. you're doing. Congresswoman Jaipal, thank you so much for joining us for a few moments, and I hope we can chat again down the road.
Thank you. What a beautiful conversation it was. Thanks for all you're doing to just increase conversation in this challenging but hopeful possible world.
Thank you so much, Congresswoman Jaipal. And more than ever, make it a point, please, to get out there, get active with your voice, and register to vote. And again, a big thanks for rating and reviewing and passing that word along to your friends and family about Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. Till next time, I'm Abhay Dandekar.